Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to our weekly EAN podcast. My name is Barbara Tettenborn. I'm the editor-in-chief of eLearning, and besides that, the head of Department of Neurology in St. Gallen, Switzerland. On my side for today's podcast is Professor David Oliver, who is chair of the European Association for Palliative Care Reference Group on Neurology and member of the management group of the EAN Specialty Panel on Palliative Care. David was consultant in palliative medicine at the Wisdom Hospice in Rochester, UK for 32 years and retired just recently. He remains involved in academic work as honorary professor at the University of Kent in Canterbury, UK, and has written and lectured widely on neurological palliative care, in particular the care of people with ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. Hello and very welcome, David.
Thank you.
It's very nice having you today. And as you all can probably guess already by the introduction of my well-known colleague, David Oliver, this month, our EAN cast has palliative care as topic of the month. And as always in our first episode, we give an overview and kind of an introduction to the topic with, of course, special reference to amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. So I will have a few questions, which I'm sure David will be able to explain and answer perfectly. So just for the start, David, could you please give us a definition of palliative care and the importance of holistic assessment of a patient?
Thank you very much for inviting me. We're really pleased to be talking about palliative care. I think perhaps to start with, I'll give the World Health Organization definition. And that says that palliative care is an approach that improves the quality of life of patients, adults and children, and their families facing problems associated with life-threatening illness. It prevents and relieves suffering through the early identification, correct assessment and treatment of pain and other problems, whether physical, psychosocial and spiritual. So it's very much with the aim of palliative care is to look at the whole person, all their issues, and see them in the context of their family. Most of us are a part of a family, and how we are affects our families and how our families are affects us. So although perhaps importantly also to stress that it talks about relief of pain and other symptoms, the definition and wider definition also says that palliative care affirms life and regards dying as a normal process. It doesn't intend either to hasten or postpone death and very much looks at the whole person. So that's the whole definition of palliative care. But I think all of us provide palliative care all the time. I think it's good care. It's listening to patients, helping them with their problems and symptoms, helping them make good plans and plan for their care and treatment. But some people, and I think neurologists are very much in this category, are involved with providing more than just basic palliative care. They're often seeing people who have those needs. Life-threatening illness is what it says in the definition. Neurology has a lot of illnesses that are life-threatening. So I think neurologists do need some extra training and expertise to talk about these issues, but they may need support from specialist palliative care services for more complex issues, whether that's symptoms or a family issue, or it may be an ethical issue, and perhaps come back to those later. So I think it's providing that good holistic care, and it's assessing all those aspects, looking at physical issues, the psychological and emotional, the social, how people are in their families, and it may be the spiritual or existential. The why me? What's going to happen to me? We can't necessarily have answers to those questions, but we can hear the questions and see if there are things we can help with, or whether there are others who within our larger teams, whether that's a psychosocial carer or a spiritual carer or a chaplain, may be able to help with those particular issues. So it's a very wide provision of care which we're all doing day by day in our normal working lives.
When I was studying medicine, palliative care did not exist in the curriculum. I suppose it probably was the same in your case. So I suppose we all involve it too little. I can only tell for myself that I suppose I asked our palliative care team, which we have in the hospital, probably too seldom. I should involve them more often, I suppose. So do you think that we all, including the neurologists, need better information on palliative care and what should be done or what can we do to increase the awareness?
I think there's a lot of misconceptions about what palliative care is. And as I said, I think we're all doing that every day with every patient by listening to them, by helping them to make plans, by involving them, and by listening to their issues, whether all those wider issues I've just mentioned. And more medical students and junior doctors are having some experience of palliative care, but it isn't universal, and it's not available in all parts of the world and even across Europe. That's particularly specialist palliative care may not be so readily available. But I think there is a real need to get over some of those misconceptions. Often people think it's only at the end of life. It's only for the last few days or weeks of life. But we've argued very much over the years to say that palliative care is needed according to the person's needs. So there may be times that they may need extra help and extra care. Thinking of someone with ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, soon after diagnosis, they may have a lot of real fears and concerns about the disease, which may need some specialist help. Then things are less troublesome to them, perhaps until they have swallowing problems. And perhaps then when they have breathing problems, and then when they're near to the end of life. But at all those times, there may be particular needs, whether they're the physical or the psychological, that may need that extra help that could be provided by the neurologist and the wider team, multidisciplinary team, but may need that extra help from specialist palliative care. So I think there is a need to help the doctors and the wider team to see that people have those needs that we can that can be helped. But there's also a need to help patients and families, because often they fear that palliative care means that they are going to die in the next few days or weeks. And I think we need to have more education about how it can be for particular needs to help them with their illness and their symptoms. And we actually did a survey 3 years ago now across Europe, and we asked palliative care specialists and neurologists through the APC and the EAN, and they said that actually only they felt that 15-20% of patients and families did have concerns about palliative care. And that was much lower than we thought. So I think there is a move, more of awareness and more understanding than there perhaps was in the past. But we still need to work on that for patients, for families, and the professionals. So there's a need to make sure that everyone knows what the role can be and how it can be helpful for people. It's helping people to live and get on with their lives, whether that's early in the disease progression or at the end of life.
It's an interesting point that you mentioned that we should involve palliative care not only at the end of life, but also earlier in the time course of the disease, which I think is a very important point. And a lot of people know by now from previous podcasts and lectures from my side that I'm very much into sports, even as a therapeutic option in neurological diseases. And I just thought in preparing for our podcast today, of course, sport plays a major role in prevention of diseases, of neurological diseases. But are there more than hints toward a positive effect of sport, maybe even in the chronic diseases? And does physical activity, not really maybe sport in a content sense, but does physical activity play a role in palliative care?
I think it's encouraging people to do as much as they can. I mean, certainly there is evidence for something for Parkinson's disease. There's been quite a lot of research on Nordic walking that can help people maintain their mobility. And I would always encourage patients and families to maintain mobility if they could and to do the things they want to within reason. We may have to temper that if someone has not as much energy reserves that they would like, and we don't want them to be extremely tired at the end of the day. But if they enjoy doing something, let's get on and do it. And obviously the other thing, it may be the watching and involving in sport. I had one gentleman with ALS who had a tracheostomy and was ventilated, but in his wheelchair, the most important part of his week was going to the sports ground to see his granddaughter playing in the football matches. And he spoke very fondly and how important that was for him to go and watch. He couldn't cheer on in the way he wanted to, but he wanted to see his granddaughter. And I think his granddaughter and all the family could take him there and be involved in that. And that was important.
Yeah, I think that's also a very good point, and being an antidepressant kind of thing, that you are involved in sport. It does not necessarily have to be actively. Actually, I watch sport I like to watch sport as much as I like to do sports. So I can be equally happy in doing both of it. No, but you have to tailor it, especially to the person, of course, to their needs and to their abilities. And at the moment, I think you find something for everybody just to be more active. It can be on a very low level and very easygoing, but I have the impression that the people are in a much better mood if they do something actively rather than just sitting down and only watching TV without moving themselves.
I think maybe going
to an event like that, yeah.
And there's more evidence of the importance of music and dance for people to remain active. And that may be easier for some people, and just keeping active and doing things. I think, as you say, it's so easy for someone who's very disabled to just sit and not do anything. And it may be easier for their carers to allow them to do that, but actually, what can they do? Is there something important? I had one lady who went to a holiday camp on holiday, and she had ALS. She was in a wheelchair. She had a gastrostomy, and she had a communication aid. And her daughter, in the evening, took her into the nightclub. And in the nightclub, she found that she could communicate much better with her communication aid than everybody else.
Yeah.
You also found that you could dance in a wheelchair and join in.
Yeah.
And all the other people in the nightclub wanted to push her around. And she also found that you could have a gin and tonic down your gastrostomy. And it didn't matter if you felt a little bit wobbly because you were in a wheelchair. So it would have been very easy for her to say, I can't talk, I can't swallow, I can't walk. But she could enjoy things. She could enjoy the dancing
and
the nightclub.
That's a very nice story. Yeah. Thank you for that. That's impressive. Yeah. So good luck to this lady. Now, with special reference to your specialty, the amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, there are so many options to prolong life, even in the end stage. You mentioned already prior in our talk that there is artificial ventilation and things like that. And I would like to know what your personal belief is, that we as doctors really have to do everything possible to prolong life, including artificial respiration, or are there situations when you think we should not do everything medical possible, but instead just comfort the patient?
I think there are many times we have to ask, and if we've got to know the person earlier, we get to know their feelings about how they would like to be cared for as they get iller. And certainly in the UK, we had guidelines when we talked that we should talk about end of life when the person wants to. And that may be a diagnosis, or it may be when starting a new gastrostomy or non-invasive ventilation, and getting their views of what they would like. And there are some people who would want to have everything done. But there are many who would say, if I can't, if I'm unable to speak and cannot do things I want to do, I would prefer that I was kept comfortable and that I was able to die comfortably with my family with me at home as I wanted, rather than being in an intensive care unit. And I think it's finding out what each particular person would like. And there may be some people would say, yes, I do want, the tracheostomy is helping me. But I would like to make that decision to stop that ventilation if I'm becoming much weaker. And certainly in many countries, and certainly in the UK, someone can say, I want to stop this procedure now. It's a very difficult decision for everyone involved. It's difficult for the person, their family, and for the professionals. But I think there are times when we may have the discussions to say, how do we keep you comfortable now? How can we make sure your symptoms are controlled and you don't become breathless or have pain or distress? And we do stop this intervention. And it is allowing someone to die of their disease. It isn't euthanasia. It's allowing them to die from their disease. Although it feels very different. The times that I've put my finger on the button and stopped the ventilator, my heart has said, I've pressed a button and the person has died. My head says, I've worked out the ethics, I've had those discussions, I know that this is what the person has asked me to do, that this is ethically correct, I'm making sure they're comfortable. But I have a debate between my head and my heart, and I have to have that support around me to help the head to win, that I can see that I'm doing something ethically and correctly. But I think there are times when patients may say, I don't want heroic treatments. I do want to be kept comfortable. And I think we need to get better sometimes about knowing when someone is near to end of life.
Do you see a lot of patients who change their mind during the course of the disease? Like, I know several people who say, as long as they are healthy and are not very ill, I don't want any prolongation of my life in case I will get very sick. And when they then finally become very sick and come to the point of the end of life, they suddenly change, or not maybe not suddenly, but they change their mind and they come to the point where they really fight for every day. Even if from the point of view of a healthy person, the value of these days might not be so high, but obviously it seems to change during the course of disease. And if human being comes to the end of life, they really want to have one more day, two more days, whatever possible.
I think it varies from person to person. There are people who cling on to life, and there are others who may accept, I know I'm getting iller, I'm accepting what's happening, I want to make sure I'm comfortable. And I think it is getting people to recognise, from the person's point of view, from the family's point of view, and from the carer's point of view, and us as professionals, that this person is getting nearer to the end of life. Because sometimes I think that people don't realise until afterwards. They look back and say, this person just died. Oh, actually, they had got iller the last 2 weeks, and I hadn't thought about that. We hadn't actually prepared for that. And I think within palliative care, we've tried to look at triggers that might give us an idea that someone was getting iller. And those might be the patient or family saying, I think I feel very tired and things are deteriorating. It might be swallowing issues. It may be cognitive change, or breathlessness, repeated infections. I think we particularly thought of people who are having an aspiration pneumonia, because I think an aspiration pneumonia shows your cough isn't as effective, your swallowing may not be as effective, your resistance is lower, weight loss, or it might be us as professionals having that gut feeling, this person's getting iller. And I think often as the doctor, I might not see patients as often as the nurses or other carers. And perhaps after I'd not seen someone for a month or 6 weeks, it would suddenly strike me that that change had happened. Whereas for the family and the nurses and the carers, the changes have come in small changes over weeks and months, and they don't. It's more difficult to see that change and realise that the person has become iller. So I think it is recognising that someone's getting towards the end of their life and then thinking, what would they want? Have we made preparations? Have we got medication ready? Do the family realise that something may happen? Because if families know, they may say, we want to be at home. We don't want to call an ambulance. If we know the person's actually is dying now, we'll cope at home for this next week or two. We don't want them being in hospital. They don't want that. We want to look after them at home. So it's allowing people that choice. But there will be some people who will want to keep going regardless. But I think we also, if we've had a chance to talk about some of these issues earlier, we may have had some of the discussions of the benefits and the risks of intervention.
Are there differences in gender? Are women behaving differently, or are they treated differently from men in regard to palliative care?
I'm on dangerous ground here, aren't I? Yes.
I don't know. I think it's my last question. So I thought I have to put it because there's so many words in the orbit at the moment about gender medicine and differences and that women are treated differently. So I just thought or wondered if that's a case in palliative care as well. Yeah.
Well, often we're talking about advanced care planning, where people would say, if I can't make decisions, these are the sorts of treatments or things I would like to happen to me or around me. And I think I heard more women say, for goodness sake, don't ask my husband, because he will make bad decisions for me. You know, my daughter knows exactly what I want.
So, and probably for the men, it's the other way around, isn't it? So they probably more rely on the decision of their
spouse,
wife, whatever.
I think everyone is so different. Everyone is so different, and it's an individual thing. I think there are men who make more decisions. And there are men who don't want to make any decision. And the same for women.
Yeah. So I think we keep it on the individual basis. Yeah.
It's an individual.
Yeah. I think that's a very good last sentence. It's a very individual decision from the doctor side, from the patient side, from the family, spouse side, how to behave in the last phase of your life. And I think we had a very, very interesting talk about palliative care. I must admit, I personally can learn a lot about palliative care. So I'm happy to be a moderator for these sessions. And I thank you a lot for being our guest today. And hope to see you soon at one of the conferences. And we try to keep the awareness of palliative care as high as possible.
Thank you very much for involving us. And it's, you know, we are very keen. And I think I can say for palliative care specialists across Europe, if neurologists want to talk about patients, want to share experiences, do so. And I think there is interest both ways round of improving the care for patients and their families. Thank you very much indeed for involving us in palliative care.
Thank you, David.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EANcast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.